Today we're starting a new series called Not in My Backyard, and if you do have a Bible with you, we're going to be in Matthew 9. We're going to spend a lot of time in just that one section of Matthew 9. Otherwise, if you don't, we'll have it up on the screens for you to follow along with us as well. But really one of the things that starts us thinking about this series is the fact that I'm sure you've started to notice that the world changes today at an extremely rapid pace. Right now, the world looks very different from whatever the world was that you grew up in, or your parents, or especially your grandparents. In fact, I looked up some statistics from the U.S. Census, because that's what I think is fun to do, and I noticed some really crazy stats that really stuck out to me. And the first one is all about education, that in 1940, 3.4 million people completed college, and in 2013, not 3.5 million, but 66.88 million people completed college. Your world changes when that kind of stat grows like that, right? Or what about employment? Employment has changed as well. In 1920, almost 100 years ago, there were 6.3 million farmers in the United States. And in 2013, 0.6. That's crazy, right? That's a crazy stat. Families are changing too. In 1965, when they did a survey, 5% of American households were headed by single-parent families. In 2017, that number is 28% of households headed by single-parent families. Things are changing, right? Things are changing in technology. Think about the parts of technology that feel like an everyday experience for you. Things like smartphones or Twitter or wireless internet, Airbnb and Facebook. What's crazy to think about is every single one of those companies began only 11 years ago. They all began in about 2007. And today it's ubiquitous. You can hardly, can you imagine your life without wireless internet? You can barely handle being here for an hour on Sunday morning with no Wi-Fi, right? Crazy. In fact, some tech experts have named this the age of acceleration. And there's a futurist named Ray Kurzweil who said, "We won't experience 100 years of progress in the 21st century. It will be more like 20,000 years of progress at today's rate." Things are moving quickly. Things are changing drastically, right? It's hard to argue that our world today isn't drastically different than it was 10 years ago or even 10 months ago. But it's not just technology and population changes that are changing. The way our world relates to faith is changing today. It's far different today than it used to be. There was a statistic from a 1963 Gallup poll that said 1% of respondents said they did not have a religious preference. That means 99% of people in the country had a faith preference, that they were engaged in faith in some way in 1963. And in 2014, 22.8% of people said that they had no religious preference. Right? It's hard to argue that things are changing, and it's hard to argue that the way our communities relate to faith is different today than it was in the past. Author Todd Bolsinger, he wrote the book Canoeing the Mountains, and he had this great quote. He said, "There used to be a day where if you didn't show up to church on Sunday, you'd hear about it from your boss on Monday," right? I can't imagine living in a world where that is true for most of us anymore today. Things are different. So if that's true, then the question for us today is, if we are people living in a changing world, what does it mean to be the church today, right? What does it mean to be individuals who follow Jesus today? What's our role in the changing world in front of us? And so for this series, a great place to start with this is to look at the life of Jesus. Jesus entered the world when he was born as a baby 2,000 years ago. Jesus entered the world at a time when things were also rapidly changing. The Roman Empire was leading the known world, and that was a huge turning point in the shift of so many things in the course of history. One simple example is that Rome did something that nobody else had ever done before them. They paved hundreds of thousands of miles of roads, and suddenly the world is connected in a way it never was before. That's a huge shift and change in the world. Even faith at Jesus' time was changing. For thousands of years, the faith community that Jesus was a part of was exclusively Jewish traditional people from generation to generation to generation. Just 15 chapters after the Gospels, in Acts chapter 15, the church says, well, I guess we got to figure out a way to let the Gentiles be part of what we're doing for the first time in thousands of years. So we are not the only ones who live in a changing world, in changing times. Jesus was in the middle of it. So how does Jesus respond in a world that's changing like that? We can say a lot about Jesus, but we want to look at how Jesus describes even his own ministry at the time where he was walking around on earth in the Gospels. And so in Matthew 11, Jesus replies. He says, go back and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor. Similarly, he repeats himself in Luke, where he walks into a synagogue and he takes his turn reading the scriptures for the day, and he opens up the scroll of Isaiah and he says this. He says, the Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has appointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recover the sight of the blind, to set the oppressed free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. When Jesus talks about his ministry, he says, what I'm doing in the changing world is about being good news. It's about bringing good news. Years later, the Apostle Paul describes Jesus the same way in 1 Corinthians. He says, now, brothers and sisters, I want you to remember the good news I told you. You received that good news message, and you continue to base your life on it. That good news, the message you heard from me, is God's way to save you. Jesus' way of life was to be good news to the world around him. Not just the global community, right, that was around him, but individuals he directly interacted with all the time. In Jesus' experience, there were people with leprosy, there were blind people, there were lame people, there were prisoners, and the choices that Jesus made was to be good news to the people that he interacted with and to be good news to his neighbors. But he didn't have to. When I look at the life of Jesus, right, Jesus could have made any choice when he was faced with a changing world. Jesus could have made the choices that I tend to make when I'm faced with a changing world. When the changing world sort of bumps up into my doorstep, Jesus could have resisted it in lots of the ways that probably you and I do all the time. When faced with something new in our life, when faced with something new in our community, we don't tend to ask how we can be good news. We'd rather say, I just don't want that in my backyard, right? When something new happens, we use that phrase. That phrase, when we think about it, we use it every single time the changing world bumps against our stable family, right? Up against our property, up against our home equity. When things start to change, that's the kind of phrase that pops into our minds. It's really a way to say, I don't like how the changing world will impact my stable life. I don't like how I might have to change the way I live or think or interact with the people around me because something or someone else is suddenly different and I didn't get a say in what was different. I heard a quote from someone not too long ago, just even talking about the incredible growth we see in our own community here in Jamestown. And he says, don't get me wrong, when they turned a cornfield into a neighborhood, I was the first one in line to build. But it's just that I don't want them to make that neighborhood any bigger or have any more people in it, right? Not in my backyard, I don't want that. They want to add multifamily housing, it's going to bring those kinds of people, and I don't want that in my backyard. Or my daughter wants to start dating someone who doesn't look like our family, who wasn't raised like we raised our kids, or doesn't sound like I want my kids to sound, and I don't want that in my backyard. In whatever way we use it, whether we think it, whether we say it, or whether we vote with it, not in my backyard is a phrase we use to keep things from changing. And I get it. It's actually a pretty normal reaction when things change for us to resist. It's natural to cling to what's the same. But here's the challenge for us as we kick off this series and as we open up Matthew 9 today, is I can't find a single place in the life and the story of Jesus Christ where he ever said anything close to, I don't want that in my backyard. So it's a challenge for us. And today we're going to dig into that challenge. We live in a changing world. How do we as the church, how do we as individuals respond? If our world is different, today than it was 10 years ago, what does it mean for us to be good news today? And so today we're going to look at three stories and one illustration that Jesus uses in Matthew 9. It's a story of stories of Jesus interacting with this exact same issues, though it doesn't look like it on the surface. When we dig in, we see how he interacts. And I think that these experiences that he has and the way he speaks about them will be deeply challenging to each and every one of us in the changing world around us. So if you have a Bible, we're going to be in Matthew chapter 9, and we're going to start with verse 1 for our first story. And this is how it starts. Jesus stepped into a boat. He crossed over and came to his own town. Some men brought to him a paralyzed man lying on a mat. When Jesus saw their faith, he said to the man, "Take heart, son, your sins are forgiven." And at this, some of the teachers of the law said to themselves, "This fellow is blaspheming." Knowing their thoughts, Jesus said, "Why do you entertain evil thoughts in your hearts? Which is easier, to say your sins are forgiven or to say get up and walk? But I want you to know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins." So he said to the paralyzed man, "Get up, take your mat, and go home." Then the man got up and went home. When the crowd saw this, they were filled with awe and they praised God who had given such authority to man. So here's what I want to notice in all three of our stories. Somebody's mad in every one of our stories, and we want to notice who's mad and what are they mad about. And in this story, it's pretty clear. The teachers of the law are upset, and they are upset because Jesus said, "Your sins are forgiven." Now, part of their issue is how this man's sins became forgiven, because Jesus just said it, and you can't just say it, right? That's not how it's supposed to go in their world. In their experience, they were used to sins being forgiven. That happened regularly. But in their experience, the way it happened was only with an animal sacrifice. And that's what the scriptures have said for generations. Throughout the Old Testament, God regularly forgave the sins of the community, but it was always through burnt offerings. You'd kill a specific animal and essentially allow the animal to take punishment for your sin that you deserved, and they would regularly burn animals as this offering to God to forgive their sins. The whole system was set up this way for the whole community. In fact, Paul in Hebrews describes the tabernacle, this religious tent that they met in through their wanderings in the desert, and he describes all the parts and pieces that go along with the tabernacle, and then he says this in Hebrews 9, "When everything had been arranged like this, the priests entered regularly into the outer room to carry on their ministry. But only the high priest entered the inner room, and then only once a year, and never without blood, never without an animal sacrifice, which he offered for himself and the sins the people had committed in ignorance." So the first thing to know is that these teachers of the law know that in order for sins to be forgiven, you've got to do it the way we've always done it. There has to be a sacrifice. But the other interesting thing is noting that these are teachers of the law, which in their custom means that they are allowed to teach the law and only the law. They are not allowed to make a new interpretation. They're only allowed to look backwards. They're only allowed to look at the words of the scriptures and say, "This is how we have to live. This is how we have to do it." You always stuck to what came before, and you ran the same path again and again and again. So part of the problem that these teachers of the law have is partly with who Jesus is and what he's doing in his ministry, but it's also partly about what he's doing in this moment. Because they see a new way to forgive sins. And they say, "That's not happening in our backyard, Jesus. This way of how we live into our faith, it's been the way it's been for our entire lives, and we need to keep sticking to that." They look backwards and try to preserve the familiarity of what's always been. And I'm sure you've never had that experience in your life. I had that experience in my life just this past month. On the very first day of the opening NBA season, every single team scored like 150 points. And I was like, I remember when the Bulls used to play the Pistons, and it was just defense. That's the kind of basketball I want to see. I like the old days better, right? That filters out into our lives in a million different ways. These teachers of the law aren't so bad because we get what it's like to preserve what's been familiar. Okay, so that's story number one. The next four verses give us another story, and they almost repeat the same situation. So Matthew 9, verse 9, Jesus went on from there. So he has an interaction with the teachers of the law, and then he goes on from there, and he saw a man named Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth. "Follow me," he told him, and Matthew got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many other tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they asked his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" And on hearing this, Jesus says, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but it's the sick. But go and learn what this means. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, for I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." Again, who's mad and why are they mad? Pharisees are mad, which is sort of the character of them every time we run into them in the Bible. Pharisees are mad, and why are they mad? Because faithful religious people like Jesus, like them, don't associate with bad people. Right? That's why they're mad. Pharisees were very much like teachers of the law. For generations, they bore the responsibility of communicating God's laws to the people. But they were different. They also taught, how do you interpret the law? Not just what the law says, but, okay, how do we play that out in our everyday life? Because the law needs interpretation. What did God mean when he said, rest on the Sabbath day? What did God mean when he said, love your neighbor as yourself? What happens when my neighbor's donkey falls in a ditch on a Sabbath day? Can I help him out or can't I? Help me. I need to figure this out. And that's what the Pharisees did. Their job was to help bring interpretation to God's law in a faithful way to help people follow God. And over the generations, it was people just like the Pharisees who interpreted God's law for the whole community. So these people, these Pharisees, they have a problem with Jesus. A faithful teacher, a religious leader like them, doesn't eat with tax collectors. Why is that? Well, tax collectors are local men, almost always men, and that they are employed by Roman tax collectors to collect money in their community. They worked for Rome. They were known associates of the mammoth pagan nation that ruled and oppressed their country. So to be a tax collector was to be a known associate with this pagan Roman empire, which is a problem for a lot of people. But for a Pharisee whose job it is to teach you how to follow God's law, it was even more of a problem. Because when God brought his people out of the desert, he brought them into the place that we call the Promised Land. But living in and around the Promised Land were all of these pagan nations, nations of people who served their own gods or had no idea about the God of the Israelites. No understanding of the God that the Israelites just spent 40 years in the desert getting to know. And God gave these post-desert Israelites some really clear rules to live by when it came to pagan nations. In Deuteronomy 7, God says, "Do not intermarry with them. Do not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons." God's pretty clear. He's pretty specific. "I don't want you intermingling with the pagan nations around us." And then he gives them a reason. In the other half of verse 3, he says, "Because they will turn your sons away from me to worship other gods." God says, "We have spent 40 years building our relationship where I'm your God and you're my people. And it's still pretty new. And I worry that if you interact with these pagan nations, it's going to take you away from me." And actually, it wasn't long before that exact same thing happened to the Israelites. Judges tells us that the Israelites intermarried with the pagan nations around them and with nearby clans, and they stopped worshiping God altogether, and God delivered them into the hands of their enemies. So, Pharisees, Jesus, tax collectors, and dinner, right? That's the background for everything that's happening in that scene. Pharisees are people who help other people live out the commands of God. God commanded them not to intermarry with pagan nations. And if you don't listen to that, big trouble is going to happen. So if you're a Pharisee, perhaps our best interpretation of when God says don't intermarry with pagan nations, our best interpretation is you should stay away from them altogether. Don't mix with them, don't interact with them, certainly don't eat dinner with them. And maybe it's best to not talk to the people who talk to them, just to keep it safe, right? So when they see Jesus having dinner with known associates of a pagan nation, they say, not in our backyard, Jesus. This is not the way it works around here. We set the rules for how this goes, and this is not the way we do things in our community. So there's two things going on in their response. First, it's, Jesus, we've taught people a particular way of doing this for a long time. There's a traditional way of living as a faithful follower of God, and you're messing it up. This is not what it looks like. But the other part of it is, Jesus, we're the ones that interpret the law, not you. Jesus, it's our position, it's our privilege to be able to shape these laws for the community. It's our power that is in jeopardy when you start doing whatever it is that you want to do. So Jesus is choosing to be good news to these people, eating dinner with them, spending time with them, and the Pharisees are choosing to protect their status, to protect their position of power, to protect their way of life. This is the way that we live, and you're making a problem for it. When you're in the Pharisees' position of power and influence, it's really easy to say things like, well, if we let those people in to our community, it's going to really mess things up for me. Heck, my property value might go down, right? It's easier to protect your way of life than it is to ask, well, how can I be good news to these people? So in a changing world, the teachers of the law protect the past. And in a changing world, Pharisees protect their position. And so those are our first two stories. Our third story is just one verse. It's the very next verse, verse 14. One day, the disciples of John the Baptist came to Jesus and asked him, why don't your disciples fast like we do and the Pharisees do? Again, who's upset and why? The disciples of John are upset. These men were following John the Baptist as their rabbi, as their teacher. And it was likely true that they spent most of their lives out in the desert. They removed themselves from the community on purpose because they said, we need to focus so much on acting right and living right and following our religious traditions that we have to get away from anybody who might keep us from doing it. So we have to get out in the middle of the desert and we're going to practice our religious traditions, our faith rituals right here. It's very important to our faith. So John's disciples are upset. And why are they upset? Fasting. Fasting. How come you don't fast like we do? Or like the Pharisees? They're okay too, but not quite like us. But they fast at least and you're not and your disciples aren't. Well, it makes sense that they would be upset that Jesus does not affirm their religious tradition of fasting. Fasting in Jesus' day was perceived as this calendared event. Everybody fasted at the same time. Fasting is simply like going without food for a period of time to focus on God. Specifically, this happened in the calendar every year at Yom Kippur. It's a solemn religious time in the Jewish year, near the beginning of the Jewish New Year. And we rarely ever hear of community fasting on times that weren't on the calendar. And it's almost unheard of for individuals to practice this in the Old Testament. So fasting was connected to an observance of religious tradition, of religious ritual, and religious rites and practices. It wasn't a personal expression of their faith. It was an adherence to religious traditions. And so they say, Jesus, good religious leaders don't forsake religious ritual. Religious rituals is what makes us feel good about how we're following God. We know we're checking those boxes. And so Jesus, when you undermine that, suddenly we feel uncomfortable. So in the face of a changing world, the teachers of the law look backwards and they seek to preserve what's always been. Pharisees look at themselves and they seek to preserve their status and their role. And John's disciples look at what's happening in this changing world and they seek to preserve their rituals and the things that make them most comfortable and make them feel most safe. And Jesus comes along and he brings good news to tax collectors and sick people. And the response of the religious leaders is essentially to say, we don't want that in our backyard. That's not how we do things. So those are three stories. Every one of these interactions kind of repeats itself in a little bit with a little different audience that Jesus is interacting with. And he follows it up in the very next verses with an illustration. Actually three illustrations, but we're going to focus on one. Three illustrations to sort of match the three experiences he just had. And this is where it starts in verse 15. Jesus replied, "Do wedding guests mourn while celebrating with the groom? Of course not. But someday the groom will be taken away from them, and then they will fast." So illustration number one is weddings, right? And then he goes on to say, "Besides, who would patch an old clothing with new cloth? For the new patch would shrink and rip away from the old cloth, leaving an even bigger tear than before." So illustration two is clothes. And then we get to the third illustration. "And no one puts new wine in old wineskins, for the old skins would burst from the pressure, spilling the wine and ruining the skins. New wine is stored in new wineskins, so they both are preserved." So we're going to hang on this one for a little bit here. Goat skins are what they would use to hold wine in Jesus' day. And as the fresh grape juice goes into the skin and it ferments and turns into wine, it expands and it stretches the skin of the container. So if you used a used skin to ferment your wine in, it had already been stretched, and now you fill it up again, and when that wine stretches, the whole thing would burst. Literally, an old wineskin can't hold new wine without falling apart. And so the lesson Jesus is bringing, first by how he interacts with these religious leaders, and then by way of this illustration, is to say, I'm bringing good news at a changing culture. There's a new culture here, and it doesn't look like it did before. Therefore, good news needs to look different today than it did in the past. What was good news for you and your religious traditions and your positions of power and your history, that was good news then, and today it needs to look different. What good news was 10 years ago is not what good news is to the world around you. So what Jesus is bringing into the world is this announcement that the world has changed, and it's time for good news to mean something new. And we live in a changing community, right? I don't walk around and have conversations with teachers of the law and Pharisees and John the Baptist's disciples. But we're living in a changing community too. Changing schools, changing families, changing workplaces. And our work in this whole series for the next month is to simply ask, how do we respond? Do we resist the changing world around us and say, I just keep that away from me. I don't want that in my backyard. Keep the change where it doesn't impact me. Or do we start and say, I wonder how we can be good news to this changing community? When college students or lower income families want a place to live in your community, what does it mean to be good news to them? When people who don't have their lives together marry into your family, what does it mean to be good news to them? When you get a new boss at work and the company starts shifting and changing, what does it mean to be good news? When your kid brings home a new boyfriend or a fiance whose life story is very different than the way your family's life has been, what does it mean to be good news? Jesus challenged these religious leaders with a choice. Cling to what you have, to what can stay the same and what can make you feel safe, or seek out an opportunity to be good news in new ways. The Apostle Paul encourages the same message to a group of Christians at a church in a city called Philippi. And he writes this in Philippians 2. He says, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but rather in humility value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others." And I love how he says this, in your relationships with one another, right? In your neighborhoods, in your communities, in your families, in your workplaces, in your relationships with one another, have the same mindset of Christ Jesus, who being in the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Didn't protect his own status, right? He made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And I get our thinking, right? When the world changes around us, there's a lot of factors to consider when dealing with a changing workplace or family or community, right? Issues of safety or property values or preservation of lifelong traditions in your family, all of these sorts of things, right? I get it. But in the face of a changing world, if my attitude does not start with looking to the interests of others over the interest of my own, then I have completely missed the boat with who Jesus was and how Jesus lived and the life Jesus invited me to be part of. It's part of the core message of the gospel. So my invitation in this series, and I think God's invitation to us as individuals and as a faith community, is to wrestle with this tension. To wrestle with this tension over the next few weeks. To wrestle with the interests we're preserving or we're seeking to preserve. Maybe those interests are your kids. Maybe those interests are your wealth. Maybe those interests are just your way of life, right? But as we wrestle with this tension of how we look to the interest of others or seek to protect the interests of ourselves, we've got to ask this question: what does it mean to be good news? What does good news mean to West Michigan today? To Jamestown? To Hudsonville? To Jenison? What does good news mean to that community? What does good news mean to your neighborhood? To your neighbors? To your coworkers? To your family members? What does it mean to be good news today when the world is changing all around us? That's a question we're going to wrestle with over the next 3 weeks. And I'd invite you to come and be part of that conversation with us to see how God wants to speak to us.